Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. This is Military Monday, and I'm your host, John Gresham. We're talking to you from Fairfax, Virginia, where it is a beautiful late winter day. The sun is shining. It's going to be probably about 50 degrees here. There is the forlorn, but nevertheless, the hope we're going to make it through winter, and there will be a spring, hopefully in about 3 weeks. Today, we're going to do a show about that group of people that Tom Brokaw of NBC News once labeled the greatest generation. Those people gave of themselves in ways that, frankly, young people today have no sense of. These were young men and some women who grew up in the Depression and came into adulthood in the midst of the greatest wartime calamity in the history of the planet. And a small group of these young men, and I say men because at the time women were not eligible to go into combat with the United States Armed Forces, these young men volunteered for what some people, quite justifiably at the time, called a suicide mission. They became members of the U.S. Army Air Forces, a group of people whose job it was to fly over enemy territory and use strategic bombing to go and destroy the wartime industry of our enemies. For a lot of them, this meant flying with the 8th and 15th Air Forces out of Great Britain and Italy. And these young men died in vast numbers. We lost thousands of airplanes doing it. And this week commemorates the moment when that fight, that great campaign over Germany, turned. 70 years ago this week, beginning on February 20th and running through the 25th, there was a new aerial campaign plan put into effect called Big Week. It was followed by a series of other strategic raids, which ran on through March and April prior to the invasion of Normandy in June. Big Week represented the decisive and overwhelming victory that eventually came about for the aerial campaign against Germany in World War II, but it also represented the bloodiest and, frankly, the most difficult part of that campaign. And to talk to us about that today, we have an old friend, my good friend, Bob Doerr, who is one of the finest aviation writers in the country, certainly one of the most prolific. He's my neighbor. He's talking to us from all of 500 yards away here in beautiful Fairfax. Bob started life as a State Department Foreign Service officer with postings in places like the Far East and Africa. And when he retired a few years back, he took up the trade of becoming an aviation writer. Bob, are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am, John. Nice to see you, and I've been writing about aviation since I was in high school.
Correct, but you have become known to people like myself over the past, quarter century that you've been doing this full-time, and been doing it pretty darn well. We're going to talk today about one of your books and the people and subjects in it. The book is Mission to Berlin. It's put out by Zenith Press. And first of all, tell us a little bit about the book and how you wound up writing it for Zenith.
John, the book Mission to Berlin is a character-driven historical narrative that's intended for general audiences, telling the story of the experiences of the young Americans that you were mentioning a moment ago, the frequently very young bomber crews and fighter pilots and maintainers of the 8th Air Force in England during World War II, who initiated and carried out the bombing campaign against Germany. Mission to Berlin. And it's a collection of personal experiences of the guys who were there.
And collected within it are a lot of stories that you've very carefully stitched together into a narrative that provides the reader a surprisingly detailed and transparent view of what it was like to go and fight during this period, both the period earlier in the war in 42 and 43 during the early stages of the strategic bombing campaign, and all the way out to 1945. This is a big subject. How long did it take you to write this, and how difficult was it to go and research?
John, you're looking at about 2 years of research, interviews, visits, flights. I flew in a B-17 as part of my research for this book. And most of it was very enjoyable. It's a bittersweet experience because these men who were so young during the air war over Europe, when we were all hoping that a bombing campaign would make it possible for the Allies to be able to invade Western Europe. They were so young then, but today those who remain are in their late 80s or early 90s, and so it is a bittersweet experience to see them aging and departing from us just when we've come to a real appreciation of how much they did for us. These men did nothing less than to save the world.
It's and in the twilight simple. Of their life, you
Indeed.
Had the pleasure and honor, I would believe, of going out and getting some scraps, some little bits and pieces of their story, and putting them together in a story for the rest of us to not only enjoy, but to take lessons from.
John, let me say a word about how young they really were. In today's military, it's not unusual for a typical basic trainee to be perhaps 21 or 22 years old. In the 8th Air Force in England in World War II, as described in my book, Mission to Berlin, you could have a 9 or 10-man bomber crew in which not a single person on board was yet 21 years old.
And these were young men who, what, had graduated high school or were drafted out of high school or had a year or two of college? What kind of demographic are we talking about?
We're talking about, and I would have to remind our readers that during World War II, the armed forces were... men, but we're talking about an era when every part of the country was different from every other part of the country. It may be difficult to believe now, but in 1944, we didn't have McDonald's or IHOP or Home Depot in every city in the United States, and we didn't have every place look the same. So the war brought together people from different regions with different dialects, with different upbringings, and yes, it was a segregated force, both by gender and by race, but it was pretty diverse nevertheless. And what they had it all in common was they were very young. You could have 10 men under the command of a 19-year-old first lieutenant in a bomber.
And commanding the units, you could have colonels, full-bird colonels, who weren't 30. I mean, it was, as you say, it was an incredibly young force.
Yes, that's very true, John. On the dust jacket of the book, Mission to Berlin, we have a rare color photo of Marvin Lord, who is one of my heroes from that period. He was a B-17 pilot and a squadron commander and later a member of the group staff and a recipient of the Silver Star. And he was a lieutenant colonel at age 23.
That's bizarre in a world where lieutenant colonels normally are 35 to 40 today.
Yes, that's right. Go ahead.
And necessarily, these were very talented young men. These were all, the enlisted men were all sergeants. The young pilots and the navigator and other people were lieutenants and captains. These were all people who would have been important members of a normal infantry unit and in superb health.
That's all true, but if you were in an infantry unit, John, you would not voluntarily go charging into the middle of an artillery barrage, whereas if you are in a B-17 bomber flying at 28,000 feet over Nazi Germany, where it is so cold that you're in danger of getting frostbite, where you need oxygen to live, where you need heat to live, you could go into battle and literally be flying directly into flak bursts. That's a four-letter word beginning with F. The word is F-L-A-K, the short term for anti-aircraft fire. And you would just have to go right through it and endure it and hope to survive.
We're going to talk a little more about what these young men had to endure, both just to survive and what they had to fight against. But for our listeners who've never really understood what strategic bombing is as a term and what it meant in World War II, let's talk a little bit about U.S. strategic bombing and how did we start our efforts at strategic bombing? What is the genesis of the idea that air power could destroy the industry and will to fight of an enemy nation?
Well, building upon lessons from the Great War of 1914 to 18 and from the work of people like General Billy Mitchell, an air power pioneer, and others, our Air Force, which was a component of the Army, but it was our Air Force nevertheless. By the way, I got myself in big trouble the other day when I mentioned a simple fact, which is that our Air Force lost more men in combat in World War II than our Marine Corps did. Our Air Force developed the idea that the bomber was the primary weapon. High-altitude daylight bombing of military and industrial targets. And the idea was a pretty good one, but it was flawed, and one of the big flaws was no one recognized that the other side would have very good fighter pilots flying very good fighters defending their homeland against this oncoming swarm of bombers.
So in other words...
Go ahead.
Yeah. So in other words, we forgot that the enemy gets a vote.
Yes. And when a very few Americans created the 8th Air Force in England, and I'm talking primarily about the 8th Air Force because that's what my book, Mission to Berlin, is about, when they started it, they seem to have believed that still, as they did in the 30s and earlier, that the bomber was always going to get through, and there were fighters available that could accompany the bombers part of the way to the target, the P-47 Thunderbolt and the P-38 Lightning, but they couldn't go all the way to the target. They couldn't travel the entire 570. The Air Force boss, Hap Arnold, in his new office in a new building called the Pentagon, had a staff that wasn't enthusiastic about the P-51 Mustang because it originally had been built to satisfy a British purchasing commission rather than being built for U.S. use. And moreover, it had been improved by adding a British engine, albeit one manufactured in the United States. So the P-51 was not all that popular with Arnold's staff and did not initially receive a very warm reception, but the P-51 had the range. It could fly from East Anglia to Berlin and have 20 minutes left to loiter around and go out and seek out the German Air Force where it lived. It had
and
range.
And as you pointed out earlier, you could put a young man with a year or two of college or some technical ability in it, teach him to fly it, and he could do this incredible thing of flying single-handed to Berlin.
Yes, one of the things that the United States did very well during World War II was training pilots. A pilot frequently had been in training at three or four different bases in the United States before he ever got to the war theater and could arrive in the theater with as much as maybe 50 hours of flight time in the aircraft that he was going to fly in combat. Our pilots were very well trained throughout the war. German side had very good pilots at the beginning, but they started to run out of pilots as the war progressed.
And, of course, in the end, it's how many, as the British learned during the Battle of Britain and the Germans learned during our campaign with them, it's all about how many veteran pilots you can get into the air in good, solid aircraft.
Yes, I think it's important to make 3 points, and I make these in the book Mission to Berlin. I make 3 points about how we defeated the German Air Force. We tried to defeat the German Air Force by going after their aircraft production facilities, and we had some success with that. But for a variety of reasons, they were still manufacturing aircraft on the final day of the war. So we also tried to go after the German Air Force by attacking their fuel, and we had even more success with that. That worked fairly well, but nevertheless, there was... The way that we defeated the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, in the air, high over hostile territory in Germany, was by killing their pilots. And that is what a few brave men in P-51 Mustangs did head-to-head in air combat with very capable adversaries. We defeated German Air Force.
And this was a very politically, very sensitive point because so many of the people who had supported strategic bombing didn't like this idea. The idea is that they thought they could go ahead and destroy enemy air power by bombing it, when in fact the actual answer was to use the bombers as bait. This obviously was not entirely fashionable or liked by either the bomber barons, as we called them, or the bomber crews.
Yes, that's true, John. And the first commander of the 8th Air Force, General Ira Eaker, is often regarded as having had that attitude that you just described. And his replacement, Lieutenant General Jimmy Doolittle, was more flexible about the use of fighters and understood that the best way to use a fighter is to go out and go after the enemy, as I said earlier, and get him where he lives.
Talk about Doctor, because he had a PhD in aeronautical engineering from MIT. Talk about Dr. Jimmy Doolittle and who he was and what he was in World War II.
America's best pilot, a man who set many aviation firsts and aviation records in the 1930s. A reserve officer, ultimately the highest ranking reserve officer in our history because he was promoted in retirement. Men in 16 B-25 Mitchell medium bombers taking off from the aircraft carrier Hornet CV-8 in the Western Pacific to attack Japan in April of 1942 at a time when our side in the war was being defeated on all fronts and there was a general feeling of gloom in the public and the aftermath of Pearl Harbor had left everyone reeling. Suddenly, the Doolittle Raiders in their B-25s struck back at the Japanese who had attacked Pearl Harbor. And although it was largely symbolic, the Doolittle Raid was an important boost to morale in the United States. And it demonstrated Jimmy Doolittle's ability and his daring and his, as it says on his Medal of Honor citation, intrepidity and gallantry at the risk of life above and beyond the call of duty. So even though, as I mentioned earlier, he eventually reached four-star rank, Jimmy Doolittle was never a colonel because President Roosevelt promoted him from lieutenant colonel to brigadier general. And sometime after the Tokyo raid that I've just described, and it's also the subject of the book 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, which was made into a movie, sometime after the Tokyo raid, he became the commander of the 8th Air Force in England, which ultimately had 650,000 men, 28 bomb groups, 26 fighter groups, 18 reconnaissance groups, each group with four squadrons of 25 aircraft, unbelievably huge force of very young men who went forth to fight in the air, and he was their commander, and he was very well regarded.
A humble man, a quiet man,
yes.
An innovative man. And let's talk a little about one of those innovations. You mentioned briefly the North American P-51 Mustang, an airplane which had originally been designed for the British, not necessarily successful in its early models, then retrofitted with a British-designed, Packard-built Merlin engine. Talk a little bit about what made this airplane so incredibly successful and, in many ways, the war-winning airplane of the European Air War.
Well, John, I've already mentioned the main thing about the P-51 Mustang that was so important. It was these three things: range, and range. it was very economical in its use of fuel, and so it could go as far as the bombers could go. It sacrificed nothing in the process. It was nevertheless a well-armed and very maneuverable and very capable fighter aircraft. So once it had traveled that distance and had arrived over the target, it could fight very, very well, and it was very, very competitive with the Messerschmitt Bf 109 or the Focke-Wulf Fw 190. And by the time that the air campaign was underway in a big way, we had far greater numbers of better trained pilots. The German side had.
Yeah, and this was an airplane so good it was capable of shooting down jets.
Well, that's true as well. The Germans introduced jets later in the war, and P-51 pilots fought them, and I've spoken to P-51 pilots who shot down Messerschmitt 262 jet fighters, And they assumed from the moment they took off and tucked in their wheels and climbed out on the mission that if they ran into a jet, they would be able to defeat it, and frequently they did.
Very impressive. And you bring up a point about range, range, and range. One of the key elements of this was something that worked not only on the P-51, which had two of them, but on other airplanes. And these were the simple expedient of drop tanks. Talk about what the effect of the drop tank was, not just on the Mustang, but on the P-38 and the P-47.
So important, John, so important. And I'm going to mention real quick in passing again that we're talking about the book Mission to Berlin by Robert F. Dorr. That's me.
Yes, it is.
The P-38 and P-47 in particular needed external fuel tanks in order to have the range to go most of the way to the target, and in the case of the P-47, eventually all the way to the target with the bombers, and an enormous amount of talent and effort and ability was put into trying to develop different kinds and different sizes of jettisonable external fuel tanks that would give that range to the fighters. The P-51 also carried external fuel tanks. I remember one fighter pilot told me that when his formation was approaching the target, the order was given to drop the tanks, which you normally do when you want to get cleaned up to go into combat. He saw all these silvery tanks falling from the sky, and he thought, you know, every one of those cost as much as a 1941 Chevrolet, and it was my dream to own one of those. But the external fuel tanks got the guys to the target, and it gave the bombers effective escort, and it enabled the air campaign to succeed, and that in turn made it possible for the Allies to invade Western Europe.
One of the things that I really loved about your book, Mission to Berlin, was that it has the ability to zoom in and really focus on some of the critical points in the air war over Germany. And one that just absolutely jumped out at me when I was reading the book was the story of what we quietly call the tactics change that occurred when Doolittle took over 8th Air Force. And there's a story here, and I'd like you to tell it, about when he went down to the 8th Fighter Command, talked to General Kepner, the head of the Fighter Command, and ordered a sign change over the door. Please tell us that story.
General Doolittle, the commander of the 8th Air Force, went to 8th Fighter Command to talk to his new boss, General Kepner of 8th Fighter Command, and there was a sign that was posted on Kepner's headquarters that perhaps you will remember the exact wording, John. I don't, but the sign spoke to the job being to protect the bombers and to stay
exactly
with the bombers. And both Kepner and not necessarily hang along flying right beside the bombers, but to go out and seek out the Luftwaffe and fight it on their terms. And so Doolittle, in fact, ordered the sign taken down and wanted a new sign that conveyed the message that our mission is to defeat the German Air Force.
And people like to say, hey, a change of signage doesn't win a war, but a change of attitude can. How big was this change of attitude? I mean, you've studied this. You've written about it, not just in Mission to Berlin, but several books. Looking back upon it, what is it you conclude in Mission to Berlin about the significance of this seemingly minor change?
it enabled our fighter pilots to do what they had innovative and aggressive, and to go on the offensive, so to speak.
I'd like to
slip in something real quick here,
please,
because I'm always asked about this. Whenever I talk about Mission to Berlin, I'm asked about the Tuskegee Airmen. So I'd like to just mention that the Tuskegee Airmen were the African-American pilots and maintainers who were trained in Alabama, and many of them became members of the 332nd Fighter Group, which was part of the 15th Air Force in Italy. And they not only had to fight discrimination in the United States, they also went and fought the Germans. And they did a wonderful job, and they deserve a lot of credit for their bravery. Theirs was just one of and they performed about as well as any of the others. No. They didn't want to, and they chose to show up. So they were not part of the 8th Air Force in England. They did eventually reach Berlin, which was a greater distance for them than it was for the airmen in England. And I'm always asked about them, so I wanted to give them a mention.
They were an outstanding group among a command of outstanding personnel that has been little regarded and has not had their story told very well. We're hoping that we'll see a book on that later this year by our good friend Barrett Tillman. But right now, let's go back to the 8th Air Force and the fighter command there, because the tactics change was an amazingly effective across-the-board measure. It affected not only losses to the bombers, but it effectively made air supremacy during the upcoming invasion possible. Did it not?
That's true indeed, John. There's a famous vignette about General Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, walking on the beach at Normandy shortly after the invasion. He's accompanied by his son, John, who at the time was an Army major. And John said something to the effect that looks like we ought to give a lot of credit to our airmen who helped to make this possible. And the older Eisenhower, the commanding general of all the Western Allied forces in the war, said, yeah, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be standing on this beach right now.
True enough. And
it was air superiority that made it possible for 176,000 Allied troops to land on five invasion beaches in Normandy on June 6, 1944.
Back to the Mustang and the people who flew it. We've talked about how young and new they were to the business of air power. There were, however, a few skilled veterans in the midst. And one of them that you talk about in Mission to Berlin is a gentleman by the name of James Howard, who had previously been a member of Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in China. Tell us about James Howard and one of his early sorties to Berlin in his P-51B.
Jim Howard had pretty much done it all. He had flown the P-40 in combat against the Japanese. He had flown a couple of fighter types in combat against the Germans, and he was on an escort mission with P-51. He had an airplane assigned to him that was named Ding Hao, which is a Chinese term that is perhaps better not translated at the moment. He was not flying. He was not flying that particular aircraft on the day of his most historic mission. He was flying a different P-51. But anyway, Jim Howard was on one of these long-range escort missions and came into a furious battle and give me a second to refresh my memory on the date of that event. On January 11th of 1944, shortly before the big week bombing effort that we've been talking about, he was surrounded and outnumbered by a massive force of German fighters, both Bf-109s and Fw-190s. He was at that point a major, which at this time in the history of our military was the right rank to be a squadron commander. And he was, as you said, a mature and experienced pilot. And he fought his way through a hellacious battle and was eventually awarded the Medal of Honor for his role in that battle. He later wrote about it in his own book called War of the Tiger, by James Howard, and that's the only Medal of Honor that went to an 8th Air Force fighter pilot during the war. So,
I always found it interesting, as was later recounted in one of his squadron mates' books, Big Friend, Little Friend, that he had shot down 6 enemy German fighters, but only claimed 3 or 4. But the bomber crews insisted upon giving him credit for all 6 and described him as that crazy Mustang pilot who wouldn't have stopped fighting.
That was James Howard.
And James Howard was not unusual. In fact, courage among the airmen of the 8th, 9th, and 15th Air Forces during this time was surprisingly common. Just getting in the damned airplane was common courage. And we're going to talk more about that here in a couple of minutes. If you want to call in and talk to Bob or myself, please feel free to call in. Area code 347-945-7246. Again, that call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. We're going to take a short break for a couple of network messages, and when we get back, we're going to talk about the young men who were part of this greatest generation.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for Rightstream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. Rightstream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. Rightstream Tuesday with Daria Ann, Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the Rightstream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website, at www.lisatarves.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
And we're back. It's Military Monday. I'm your host, John Gresham, and we're here with our guest today, Bob Doerr, talking about his book about the airman who flew the air campaign over Germany, called Mission to Berlin by Zenith Press. Are you still there, Bob?
I am still here, John.
One of the qualities about this book that I was just really taken by was your individual, very personal looks at what it was like to be a crewman on a bomber crew, a maintenance guy, a fighter pilot. I mean, you really capture with your descriptions, as well as others that you found along the way, a sense of just what an insane lifestyle these people led and just exactly what we were asking them to do. I want you to take a little time and describe, and I know this is going to be a poor metaphor, but what was a day in the office like for a young bomber crewman who gets waken up before the dawn and gets told, "You got a mission today, sir."
If you're a night, East Anglia, it's always wet and damp and cold. It's wet and cold in your barracks. It's cold outdoors. And when you're flying, you're really, really cold all the time because you're in an airplane that is open and not pressurized. So life revolves around being cold. You get wakened up at 3 to 4 a.m. for the mission. You go to chow, you go to the chaplain, you go to the briefing, you're cold the whole time. You learn about the flak and fighters that are going to be facing you when your B-17 force approaches Nazi territory in Europe. But you know what worries you the most? It's those two college boys up in the pilot's seat up in front of you, because you, as a young teenage crew member, have no control over what happens to that airplane. And when you put 2,500 airplanes with 15,000 men into the air over Europe on one day, no matter how you do it, somebody's going to have a collision. Somebody's going to fly into somebody else. So here you are, you're 19 years old, you're cold, you're being told that a whole bunch of people are going to try to kill you with anti-aircraft fire and with fighters, and you're freezing, and you have no control over what happens to your airplane, and you know that somebody's going to die in a collision today because it's statistically impossible that that won't happen. And you know what? These kids get up every morning and climb into those airplanes, and they go face those flak and fighters, and they face the cold, and they maintain good spirits and good cheer. Some of them are pranksters. Some of them are people that you would love to have as friends and neighbors. God bless them. As I said earlier, what they did was nothing less.
And there were a lot of unpleasant aspects to this over and above what you just described. I mean, while they were well fed by the standards of the war, particularly compared to their British counterparts, U.S. airmen, their diet was heavily restricted because, obviously, you don't want to feed them certain types of foods before they go up into the upper stratosphere. And at the same time, if they have a head cold or any neuromuscular problems, they can't fly. I mean, this is a very, very fit group of people we're sending off into battle.
Yes, that's all true. And it's just incredible that they were able to get up and do it every day. Not, of course, literally every day, but almost.
And the reality they lived in was really binary. What were the possible outcomes of a mission for that tech sergeant who's a gunner in back or a radio operator? What are the outcomes that person can look forward to on a mission?
In all wars, about half of your aircraft losses are going to be to non-combat causes. So one of the things that this young... could take place. If that doesn't happen, you could get blown up by anti-aircraft fire or shot down by Messerschmitts. You could have any number of other things go wrong. And what they tell me, you know, when I was writing the book Mission to Berlin, what they told me in interviews was that they just never thought about all these great dangers that they were facing. They just went and did it, and I think it was partly because everybody else went and did it.
And how bad could it get? We're going to talk a little bit about the March 6th mission to Berlin, but just how many airplanes out of a force could you lose on a given day at the office?
In the early part of the air campaign, John, as you know, we lost 60 bombers in one day on the second Schweinfurt-Regensburg mission, mostly because they did not have proper fighter escort. And I just think 60 bombers with 10 men on board each. And that brings to mind a thought that I want to express that I hope listeners will be interested in. You know, most Americans can tell you the names of some great battles. They can tell you the name of Gettysburg or Antietam or Belleau Wood or Iwo Jima. But not quite as many know about these vast air battles that were fought across vast reaches of the sky by formations of bombers that took 3 hours to pass overhead. Schweinfurt, Regensburg, Ploiești, Berlin, those are the names of battles in which Americans fought. And as many times and as much as they've been celebrated in stories like 12 o'clock high, I just don't think that those young men have ever fully received enough credit for everything that they did in those great air battles. So that's why I wrote the book, Mission to Berlin.
Yeah, and to put a metric to it, when you talk about losing 60 bombers on a raid, that's 600 men.
Yes.
Who are going to be killed, captured, or missing, not counting anybody who's wounded on a bomber that manages to make it back. 600 men is an infantry battalion. That's an entire battalion of men that's been wiped off your table of organization equipment, and it happened in a day.
Yes,
I mean, we wouldn't accept losses like that today.
You mentioned the wounded. On the radio, but just imagine being in an open, cold airplane that is bouncing around with people being gravely wounded all around here. It's just what these guys went through is just almost unbelievable today.
And going back to the point you made about it being cold, it was so cold they had to have electrically heated, fleece-lined leather flight suits. And if they bled, their blood would freeze in the scuppers of the aircraft. I mean, the environment wasn't just hostile. It was bizarre.
The air campaign over Western Europe was the only occasion in our history when military members were awarded the Purple Heart for frostbite.
As well they should have, among other injuries that we know they suffered.
Yeah.
And for those who don't understand, the enemy we were fighting against was pretty damn good. I mean, talk a little bit about the Luftwaffe in late 43 and early 44 that these task forces of bombers would face any time that they crossed the enemy coastline into occupied Europe.
The German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, was still heavily manned by very experienced, very well-trained, very mature fighter pilots who had been fighting ever since the beginning of the war on September 1st, 1939, had fought through the battles in Poland and France and the Battle of Britain. And they had been there and done that with just about everything that you could do in air combat, and we had not yet reached the point where we were beginning to thin out their ranks. So they were a very formidable force, and they had very good equipment, particularly
and the
Focke-Wulf 190.
Yeah, and they were headed, of course, by a roughly 30-year-old fighter ace, Adolf Dofo Galland, who you and I have both met, who himself had 100 kills.
Yes.
I mean, this is a force that is formidable, and that doesn't even include the guys on the ground who were firing flak up there. I mean,
yes, indeed.
You talk about being willing to go and run into an artillery barrage, and yet how many times was an average crewman expected to do this? How many of these missions were they expected to fly on a tour before they would be relieved and get to go home?
American bomber crews initially were expected to fly 25 missions. When that was first created as the requirement, it was the odds were heavily against that happening. Things improved significantly, and so it was raised to 30 and later raised to 35 missions later in the war. I do want to be sure that we take a moment to tell readers how to find me if they want to.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
We're going to make sure that we get that done, but let's just say, Bob, how can they find you, and how can they go and find your book?
Well, they can start thinking about the 703 area code. I'm Bob Doerr. I'm the author of Mission to Berlin. And anybody who would like to is strongly encouraged to call me on the phone. The number is 703-264. Robert F. Doerr, D-O-R-R. And I love to talk to people who share my interest in this subject matter. So I would love to get a phone call from anybody who's interested in the experiences of these bomber crews, Big Week, B-17s, P-51s, whatever.
And we're going to go ahead and make sure that they get to hear that all again. So if you want to take that number down again, we will give it to you at the end of the show. We have one last segment we want to talk about, which is Big Week and the March 6th raid to Berlin. Now, let me just say that in Mission to Berlin, Bob's book on the air war in Western Europe and the people who flew it from the American side, this is just a little itty-bitty part of this book. It's a chapter and a half. But that chapter and a half is, of course, the turning point. And I wanted to go and, in the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of Big Week, I wanted to talk a little bit about those two events, the raids that ran between February 20th and 25th, and then jump forward to the big raid on Berlin on March 6th. Lay out for us how all those changes we talked about, the introduction of the Mustang, Doolittle being in charge, the drop tanks, and the tactics change, they come into full force in Big Week. What is the immediate effect for the bomber crews and on the Luftwaffe?
We are indeed, as you say, John, right in the middle of the anniversary. Big week was February 20-25 of 1944. It was the massive bombing. Argument, and it was the time that marked the maturing of the 8th Air Force and of the till that time we really had not yet sorted out the need for a fighter escort. We really had not properly recognized that the P-51 was the right airplane for that job. They began arriving in England in late 1943, and by the time of Big Week, they were finally available in significant numbers. So now we finally had drop tanks, we had fighters, we had range, we had B-17s, and we had a much better prospect of survival for bomber crews now that our own tactics had improved. Our understanding of how to conduct this air campaign had improved, and Big Week was a massive show of force. You use a word that was unpopular with a young group commander named Curtis LeMay, the word raid. LeMay flew off the handle one day when a reporter used that word with him. He said, "Listen to me, young man. I am sending thousands of men out there to wage a massive battle across hundreds of miles of space, 28,000 feet in the air. This is not a raid. What Jimmy and those boys did in Tokyo, that was a raid. This is a battle." And I've said it before on this program, but I got to say it again. I can't emphasize too much. These were great battles that took place in the sky.
And these were not initially bloodless things. In fact, the level of combat was actually increased over what had been seen the previous summer and fall. And there were a lot of losses on the American side, correct?
Yes, that's true. Although we were... By the time of Big Week in late February of 1944, we were beginning to experience lesser losses on the average on a mission than previously. And this, of course, brings us up to March 6th, the first occasion when a significant number of American bombers reached Berlin.
Now, there'd been tries before earlier in the month, but weather had obviously been a problem, still being winter at the time. Talk about the setup for the March 6th raid and just how big and how massive the force of American bombers was.
It's probably worth remembering that we had airfields all over East Anglia. Believe it or not, we actually built 300 airfields in England during World War II. So imagine that perhaps somewhere around between 30 and 50 airfields are devoted to nothing other than heavy bombers. And
yeah.
Everyone that could be gotten into the air was gotten into the air for the march. The first serious attempt to bomb Berlin was on March 4th, and that was fouled by weather, although a handful of aircraft did reach the German capital. But the first aircraft that got over Berlin that day, perhaps you do, John. Anyway,
yeah.
It would have been in the many hundreds, probably over 1,000.
Over 1,000 bombers,
yeah.
Hundreds of, and the Luftwaffe was out in full force because obviously they would be able to take off, fight them on the way in, land, refuel, rearm, and fight them on the way out. It was going to be a big, big fight that day.
Yes, it was indeed a big fight that day. And incredibly enough, and perhaps, again, as a reminder of the point I keep repeatedly making, that these are battles, the number of people who were killed in the air that day was about the same as the number of people who were killed on the ground by American bombs.
You talked earlier in the show regarding the stories in Raid on Berlin, Mission to Berlin, that this was, among other things, a bittersweet and sometimes heartbreaking story. And I'd like to have you tell just a little bit about one of maybe the most heartbreaking things that day. What happened to the aircraft of the 100th Bomb Group, and why did they earn on March 6th the title of the Bloody 100th?
The story is widely told that a 100th Bomb Group aircraft that was badly damaged when it was engaged by German fighters, and the bomber crew lowered their landing gear, which was the symbol of surrender or a sign of surrender, and the German fighters drew in closer. And then, as the story goes, the bomber crew retracted the landing gear and opened fire with their machine guns and shot down a couple of German fighters. That's the legend, and we could devote an entire program to going into exactly what really happened and whether anything like that happened. But that created the belief on the part of the Americans that the Germans had it out for the 100th Bomb Group, and that whenever they saw the 100th Bomb Group after that, they would specifically target that group because of that incident, which was perceived as a violation of the law of armed conflict. The whole legend, including the idea that the Germans singled out a single American bomb group for special treatment, is something that needs a lot of scrutiny. I would be very skeptical of it.
That said, what kind of losses did the 100th Bomb Group take on March 6th? And what was the situation at the end of the day back at their home station?
They took heavy losses. I, again, don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but imagine being back at the home station and imagine being the crew chief of a B-17 or the armorer or the ordnance guy, and you've worked your heart out to make this airplane ready to fly into battle. And once it has departed to go on the mission, there's nothing for you to do.
And at the end of the day,
there's nothing worse in war than hurry up and wait. And there's nothing to do but wait and start seeing who comes home at the end of the mission.
And in the case of the 100th Bomb Group back at their home base, one airplane came back, just one of all the ones they dispatched that day.
One bomber, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, it needs to be said that several others diverted and were able to land at other bases in Britain. But this was a bomb group that was virtually wiped out in a day. A day. One battle. I mean, we would never tolerate that today, would we, Bob?
Averse to having casualties, and warfare has changed. But on the other hand, our expectations are different.
Bob, to finish up talking about these young men, These are all people who saw absolutely some of the most horrifying things possible in their combat careers. There were a lot of survivors, particularly the ones later in the war who fought in 44 and 45. But there were huge numbers, as you point out, who were lost. More airmen lost than the Marines lost in all their battles during World War II. What was their contribution to victory, and how were they valued today?
It's important to put all of this into perspective. There are differing opinions as to how effective the air campaign was over Western Europe. You'll notice that I use the word Western a lot because the overwhelming mass of inertia that defeated Nazi Germany came from the East, from the Soviet Union. We should not forget that the Soviets had... referring to the West, where we're interested, and which is the subject of the book Mission to Berlin, I don't think there's any doubt that had the air campaign not made progress, and had there not been significant progress during big. Had that not happened, I don't think the Allies would have been able to land in Normandy. I don't think you'd have seen the liberation of Paris. I don't think you'd have seen the Western Allies crossing the Rhine into Germany. All of those things might have happened eventually sooner or later one way or another, or they might have been delayed long enough that they might not have happened. And so it's we owe it all to these young men, and by the way, huge numbers of them also became prisoners of war because lots and lots of guys parachuted out of airplanes. We owe it to all of them that we were able to do our part in the West to defeat Nazi Germany and bring about victory in World War II, and as I said earlier, save the world.
And with that, we're pretty much done telling their story today, but what we aren't done with is letting you one more time talk to the listeners and tell them how to reach you, both on how to buy your book and how to go ahead and talk to you, because one of the key parts of what you do as a writer is you talk to people. You talk to veterans. You talk to the sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters of veterans. Tell us that again.
I do that every day, John. Yes, I'm going to repeat the basics. My name is Bob Doerr. If you look for my byline on my book, it's Robert, middle initial F, like in Frank. The last name is Doerr, D-O-R-R. We've been talking about a book titled Mission to Berlin. Mission to Berlin by Robert F. Doerr. And I would like to encourage anyone with an interest in this subject to call me on the phone. If you want to buy a book, you can get it from me, but you don't have to buy a book to talk to me on the phone. All you have to do is remember my number, which is 703-264-8950.
And can you give them your email address, too, please?
Yes, of course. Robert.f. From anyone who shares my interest in this part of our military history.
Bob, I want to thank you for coming on the show again. For those who haven't followed Military Monday for long, Bob has been on our show a number of times talking about his books and other subjects. Late in the year, we had the pleasure of talking to him about his excellent work, Fighting German Jets, also by Zenith Press. Bob, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again sometime soon when you've got a book to talk about.
It's been a great pleasure to talk with you today, John.
Thank you for coming, Bob, and I'll be talking to you soon. Take care, my friend. And with that, we've come to the end of another Military Monday. I hope that you enjoy this program. We certainly enjoy putting it on for you. For those who might not have noticed, we've been doing this almost a year, and next week we're going to have both a Military Monday show and a anniversary show for the Rightstream Radio Network, which we are part of. For my show, we're going to have another friend of ours who's been here before to talk about the AV-8B Harrier and its history. And that'll be Lon Nordine, who has written a book with Naval Institute on the history of the Harrier II, along with other things. And we're hoping that he'll be able to bring along with him a friend who is an actual Harrier squadron commander. Then on Tuesday, March 4th, we will be doing a special anniversary show with Daria DiGiovanni, also here on Rightstream, that we're going to recount some of what we hope are our greatest moments, and certainly some of the achievements and what we've actually built in the last year. I want to thank everyone who's been with us for a year, and hope that you'll join us for these shows. Please have a great week. Stay warm, stay safe, and we'll look forward to seeing you again next week on Military Monday.
Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's the song?
There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flare through a pawn shop, a flare through a pawn shop. May he forget why he is